Good morning, everyone. We're so glad you've joined us this morning here at LifePoint. Today, we're continuing our series, Building a Great Life, and we've been looking at the Ten Commandments, but with everything that's happening in our world today, we're pivoting, we're going to change direction, and we're going to look at racism and prejudice and riots, something that's affecting our communities, because here's the truth. It's hard. It's impossible to build a great life in a world that is so divided, in a world where there's so much disunity, in a world where our black brothers and sisters are dealing with racism and prejudice, and where all of us wake up in the morning and we feel unsafe in a world that's exploding with anger. And over the last few weeks, I've been heartbroken and angry at some of the stories that have come out. And you've heard the story of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. Here's a black man who decides one day he's going to go for a run. And he's running, and suddenly two white men in a pickup truck are trying to track him down. And two times they try to grab him, but he eludes them. But the third time, they corner him, and they pull out a shotgun, and they shoot him three times, and he dies. And we hear that story, and it's just so tragic and horrifying. And a 36-second video clip revealed what actually took place to the world. And we saw this, and we were horrified. And what's really scary about this whole thing is that not only was this man killed for doing nothing but going out for a run, but there was also this kind of systemic thing going on where there was a cover-up. We soon learned that there was no arrest for many, many weeks. Local authorities did nothing. They took no action. The first DA recused herself because she had a working relationship, with one of the shooters. The second DA, the second prosecutor, got the evidence in the case and concluded this, that there were no grounds to arrest any individuals involved in Arbery's death. He concluded that under Georgia law, this is perfectly legal. They were only trying to stop and hold this criminal suspect. But as you hear that, you have to ask the question, why was Arbery a criminal suspect? He hadn't done anything wrong. There was nothing that he had done. Lies started to come out to kind of cover this up. Lie number one was that the suspect was basically in a neighborhood where there had been a lot of thefts recently. But police confirmed later that there hadn't been any burglaries or thefts for many weeks. And so that was the first lie. The second lie that came out was that Ahmaud attacked them. But think about this. What would you do if men were coming after you? And two times you eluded them. You were trying to get away. But the third time, it's like, I'm being attacked. You'd grab the gun. You're fighting for your life. So that was a lie, too. They were pursuing him. The third lie was that Arbery had stolen something. Turns out that there was a house construction site nearby, and there was a videotape of Arbery walking into this house. It's under construction. He walks in, but he took nothing. He stole nothing. In fact, the videotape confirmed that kids had walked through this construction zone. Other people had. It really made me think about Denise and me. When we were moving into our community, there were new houses going up too, and I walked into them as well. I was curious. I just walked in. That's what he did. And the homeowner confirmed later that in fact nothing at all had been taken. It really comes down to this, that Ahmaud was guilty of only one thing, being black. And he was pursued by men who had a pretext. In fact, this looks like a classic case of pretext. A pretext is a false justification for an action. Here, two racist men use crime as a pretext to attack and kill an innocent man. And it's horrifying. Ahmaud ultimately, this case regarding his murder, his death, finally went to a third prosecutor who also would not take the case. So we got case, none of these DAs are taking the case. Finally, it went to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and they charged these men after many weeks with aggravated assault and murder. And what's tragic about this is not only the loss of this young man's life, a young guy, 25 years old, who has his whole life in front of him. Not only is that a horrible tragedy that should never happen, but what is also scary is that there was this kind of systematic cover-up behind the scenes, that all these powerful people were in fact not dealing with it, that these two racist men could have gotten away with murder had that 36-second video never surfaced. These things should never happen. This man lost his life for absolutely no reason. A few weeks later, we heard the story of George Floyd. On May 21st, 46-year-old George Floyd was at a convenience store, and he used a fake $20 bill. The police were called, and within 17 minutes after the police arrived, Floyd was pinned under three officers, no longer showing any signs of life. And in fact, the one officer who was pinning his neck to the ground had been on him for a very long time, on him when he was talking and said, "I can't breathe." He was pinning him down when the man went unconscious. And in fact, he never changed it. He continued. He continued with his knee on this man's neck even until the paramedics arrived. And that was the cause of his death. He could not breathe. He suffocated. And it was such horrific, horrible actions. And it took us all and shocked us all and just undid us all to see this take place. George Floyd died that day because he used a fake $20 bill. How in the world does that make any sense? It doesn't at all. And now we have this horrible image that's going to be etched into the collective mind of the country of this white officer pinning this black man to the ground. And good cops all over the country are going to say, "Wow, this is an image that is horrifying." And people all over the country, good people who are not prejudiced, hate this. But it is what happened. And in fact, it's another action taken by a white person to kill a black man. And it should never, ever have happened. Now, this is not an indictment of police officers. This is not an indictment of all white people. But it's a reminder to all of us that racism and prejudice and discrimination, these things are alive in our world. And they're not just personal in nature, but there seems to be a systemic nature to them as well. And it's always wrong. It's always evil. But these issues hit me really hard because I now was taking something that was so horrible and bringing it closer and making it personal. And that happened when a friend of mine, a member of our church, Marcus, posted something on Facebook. Marcus is the one who led worship today. I didn't even know he was scheduled to lead worship, but that's the way it played out today. But Marcus posted something on Facebook about the day he decided to take a run through his own neighborhood. And he talked about how he can't be out there. He can't jog. He can't get exercise. He can't run around his community without taking a lot of things into consideration. He, for example, has to be careful about what he wears. Definitely no hoodies. He has to be careful about this idea of wearing a mask because maybe people would wonder what that's like, a jogging mask. If he passes someone, he says he always has to smile because people feel threatened by him. And he even wonders about his neighbors, some who maybe have even seen him before. He wonders how they're going to respond when they see him jogging in the community, like right down the sidewalk, like in front of his own house. He wonders how his own neighbors might respond. Would they call the police? Would they think something bad's happening? Would they take matters into their own hands? These are calculations Marcus has to make all the time. Just getting some air, just going out for a jog, just trying to stay in shape, it's really complicated. He goes on to say this: "Those are just some of the thoughts I have. Those are just the thoughts I have while preparing for my run. Can you imagine what it takes for black people to prepare for a job interview, a promotion, getting a loan to buy a house, sending our kids to school, shopping, etc.? When I read that, I was heartbroken. I've spent time with Marcus, and we've talked about race issues. He never told me that story before, and it was heartbreaking to me because I don't want to believe it's true. I want to believe that the world is getting better and that those things don't happen, that my friend can go out for a jog and not have to do all those calculations and work all these filters. I don't want to believe that that happens, but the reality is it does. And as a white person, a white man, I'm insulated from that. I don't experience that like he does. When I go for a walk or a run or I'm outside, I don't have to deal with this potential danger. I think so much about how people might hurt me. And as I thought about all this, a scripture came to my mind. And it's this, it's Galatians 6:2. And it says this, carry each other's burdens, and this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. The context here is of mature believers when they see a brother or sister fall. So it's a different application. It's a different issue. It's a spiritual issue at first that Paul is addressing. And he's talking about how mature believers should come along and restore those who have fallen into sin or temptation. So it's a different issue at first, a spiritual issue, an issue regarding how we restore those who are broken. And the church historically has been pretty bad at that too, that people fall and we don't help them, we judge them. That's another topic for another day. But there's also something way more broad happening here as well. You see, this here is speaking about burdens, that there are brothers and sisters in our world, in our community, in our church, who are bearing burdens. And the word burden speaks of a stone, of a rock, of a weight. And this weight is like seriously heavy. This is a heavy weight. It's a burden. It's difficult to carry this. It's something that I have to put a lot of energy in. Oh, man, I got to put a lot of energy in just to kind of hold it. I got to put a lot of energy into this to move it. You know, I can't escape this burden. I've got this burden in my life. I got this burden on my back and in my world, and it's on me and my family, and I got this thing. And I just moving from point A to point B, just going about my normal life, I'm weighed down, seriously. That's the language Paul has in mind here. It's a burden. It's heavy. It's very hard to bear. The burden is like that stone, that weight. It's not like this tote. You know, I was looking for a tote, and I don't have totes. Fortunately, my daughter, she has totes. And so I got this tote, and a tote is basically something that you use to carry small items, little items. And you can move them to point A to point B. You carry it around, and you put it down, and you pick it up, and then you put it down. It's not really too hard. You don't have to exert yourself too much. What Paul's talking about here in terms of burdens is not a tote. It's a stone. It's a weight. And carrying it day after day absolutely wears someone out. And Paul's saying we're to carry one another's burdens. In other words, I have a responsibility as a Christ follower to consider the best interests of my brothers and sisters around me. I have a calling and responsibility to bear some of this weight for them, to come alongside them and love them and learn how I can help them, how I can lift them up, and maybe even remove some of the weight. Here we have a situation in our world where we have black brothers and sisters who are carrying a unique weight, and it's our role to come alongside them to help remove that weight, to bear some of that burden. And then it goes on to say here that this fulfills the law of Christ. Now, we think about the law of Christ. I mean, there are over 600 laws in the Old Testament, but Jesus summarizes the law in one word. It is love. When we love others, we fulfill the law. We are obeying, conforming our lives to the law of Christ. And the law of Christ is the earmark of true faith. It's the clearest sign to the world that we actually know and love God. And there are so many scriptures that talk about this calling to love others. John 13:34 says, "A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another." My command in John 15:12, my command is this, love each other again as I have loved you. 1 John 3:23, and this is his command, to believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and to love one another as he commanded us. Now, there are all kinds of applications to this passage, but today we're talking about a deep-seated problem in our country, and that is prejudice and racism. And that means that for me as a Christ follower to obey this, I need to come alongside, again, my brother and my sister. And I need, you know, to say, I don't understand all the issues you as a black friend deal with, but I come alongside you to bear some of that weight. I want to oppose the things that hurt you. I want to bear some of that weight. I want to understand what you're going through, and I want to stand and speak against prejudice and racism when I see it. I want to be the kind of person who opposes anything that stands against the law of Christ, the love of Christ. And so that's my role here. That's a direct application. That's something that we should be doing to support bridge building so that we can solve problems, so that everyone can live a good life. And so the question is, how do we do this? How do we build bridges? How do we bridge the gap between different people? How do we make this work? I think the first thing is this, that we need to listen to each other's stories. Have conversations regarding race. Listen to each other's stories. Have conversations about race. Because here's the truth of the matter. Everyone has a story. You have a story. You have a story about race. And so maybe you're in a situation where you grew up and you had good experiences with those who were different than you. You had good experiences. Maybe you had bad experiences. Maybe your experiences were mixed. Maybe you were in a situation where you're this white kid in the playground in eighth grade and this black kid beat you up. Well, that's your story. Or maybe you're a white couple that was driving down the road one day and you had some trouble. You had a flat tire and two black men came up and they pulled behind you on the highway and they got out and they helped you change the tire. Maybe you've had good experiences or mixed or bad experiences. Maybe you were raised in a home that was tolerant and where people weren't treated differently because of the color of their skin. Or maybe your parents were pretty racist. Maybe there was a lot of prejudice. Maybe the Confederate flag that they hung on their wall wasn't so much about Southern pride, but it really was a jab at black people, and you knew it. You knew it. You felt it. That's your story. That's where you're coming from. And I think what we have to do is to say, I've been influenced in certain ways, but I need to have a conversation with somebody who's different from me. I need to have a conversation. I need to build a bridge. I need to talk about some of these different issues because my story needs to be heard, but I also have to go to the next step. It's not just enough to have a conversation. That's big, and I know some of you at our church are having that conversation. I know some of you called others in all of this who are affected differently. You know, some of you white brothers and sisters have called black brothers and sisters, and some of you have called police officers or in our church, and you're having conversations. That is phenomenal, phenomenal. But we have to go to the next step, not just to have a conversation, but we also need to think more broadly to interpret our story. We have to think more broadly to interpret our story. Let your story interact with other people's stories so you can interpret your experience. Other people's stories help us understand our own story and help us determine if the narrative we picked up in our home or our community or experience is actually accurate. Maybe what I learned was right, or maybe it really was so off base. Now, I was raised in a home where my parents accepted other people. There wasn't any prejudice in our home. We didn't treat people any different, regardless of who they were or where they came from. And so as a young guy growing up, I had a good start in terms of race issues. I wasn't really judging people by what they looked like. Now, I was born and raised in Bloomfield, New Jersey, and I know some of you in our church, you hold that against me because I'm from New Jersey, but I am from New Jersey. And when I was growing up, the town next to me was Newark, New Jersey. And at that time, it was a very violent town. There was a lot of things going on, a lot of shootings, a lot of muggings, a lot of bad things were reported in the media over and over again. People were getting shot, and since the community was largely black, the media portrayed people constantly in the news, portrayed black people as both the perpetrators and the victims of violence. And so I'm trying to make sense of this in my own life, and I found one day that I had to kind of figure this out in a very, very direct way, that I was confronted with the issue and had to work my way forward. Because when I was growing up, I sang a lot. I was in a lot of choirs. I did a lot of that kind of thing. And the choir director at my church invited me one day to a field trip. And that field trip was in Newark. She taught music at Newark High School. All her students were black, mostly black. And she invited me on this field trip. And I remember thinking about this. Wait a minute, I have to go to Newark. So how do I figure this out? I want to go. I think I should go, but I had to process it. I asked the question, I'm a white guy. Am I going to be safe? I'm a white guy. Am I going to be accepted? Will I be an outsider? Will this be rough? Those are the honest thoughts in my mind. I had a friend at the time, this big Hispanic kid. His name was Carlos. Carlos weighed about 300 pounds. And I knew Carlos was going on this field trip with me. So honestly, that gave me a little bit of security in this. Like, okay, Carlos is there. And so I decided, you know what? I got to figure this out. I want to go. I'm going. So I went on the trip. And I remember getting on the bus. I walked onto the bus. I was one of the last people on the bus. And I looked around, and I realized I was the only white kid on the bus. And I was like, wow, this is a new experience. I want to try to understand this. And I remember sitting in the school bus seat. And do you remember the school bus seats? I mean, some of them could be really tight. Well, Carlos took up so much of it that I barely had any room. But, you know, I didn't care because he was there. And I was like, just in case something goes weird. But here's the truth. Nothing went weird. Nothing was awry. In fact, that day, we had a great time. And I heard more of Carlos's story, and my story interacted with his. But I also met a lot of the black students, and I heard their stories, and I interacted with that as well. You see, based on the information I had had before going into Newark, I was kind of nervous. I was scared about it. I went anyway. But now, as I was learning about people, I realized that they were seeking the same things that I was seeking, that they wanted to live a good life. They wanted to be safe. They wanted to have a fun field trip. So did I. And this broadened my understanding. It wasn't just enough for me to have a story, but to interact with their story to kind of figure out what is real and what is true. Ultimately, it also helped me critique the media messages that were constantly violent about black men. Those kids were awesome. I had a terrific time. I learned a lot about race that day. So listen to the stories of your black brothers and sisters. Don't say, oh, I don't think that's real. I don't think that's happening. No, listen to their stories. They're valid. They're real. And learn from those stories. I know wives today who are married and their husbands are black and they worry every day when they leave the house. They worry, are they going to come home from work? Will they come home from a run? This is a tough time. A deep-seated issue in our country. We need to have conversations with our black brothers and sisters and let our story interact with theirs. We need to have conversations with cops that we know, too. That there are hundreds of thousands of good cops in this world. They hate what's happening in this world. They get attacked as being racist. The stories of cops who took this, made this commitment to protect and serve and who, again, hate what's going on in the world. They're not prejudiced. But they realize that, man, they're standing and they're kind of in situations where it's really difficult. They don't feel safe. Their wives also are worried. Their husbands, if their wife is a cop, they're worried about whether they're going to come home as well at the end of the day. And then talk with those who are different from you, whether they're Hispanic or Mexican or Asian, whatever they might be. But today we're talking about racism in our country. And that means we need to have a conversation with our black brothers and our black sisters, our black friends, our black coworkers. We need to hear their story. That's what we're talking about today, because their story can shape our own. But there's some things that keep us from hearing that story sometimes. There are some things that happen from time to time that when we feel pressure, this is what we do. We don't want to hear their story anymore. We just kind of pull into ourselves, pull into our own cocoon, and we circle the wagons around our group, our race, our profession. We circle the wagons and we pull everyone into ourselves and say, hey, wait a minute, what about me? What about me? What about my circumstances? And we kind of defend ourselves and we throw out volleys and attack others. But when we're in that mode, we're not listening to our black brothers and sisters. We're just kind of pulling into ourselves. We also have this tendency sometimes to attack other people and not even realize that it's happening. Some of us do, some of us don't. There are Facebook posts out there from people who say things about race and racial issues, and they've never had a conversation with a black person. They've never had a conversation about race to get a different perspective. And they don't realize that, in fact, what they're saying is not really broadly understood. And then some people even go so far as to make sweeping generalizations. They take their story and they say, yeah, because I had this bad experience with a black person, therefore all black people are this. Or I had this bad experience with a white person, all white people are that. These sweeping generalizations about cops and other people, Hispanics, Mexicans, Jews, the list goes on and on, is never helpful. It's always, always flawed. Problem solving and racial reconciliation always involves listening and understanding and putting yourself in the other person's shoes. But there's something else here that I don't want us to miss. We need to recognize the true source of the problem. Recognize the true source of the problem. White people are not the problem. If you removed all the white people from our country, do you know what would happen? Racism would emerge in a new form. It happens in other countries where there are no white people, where light-skinned and black-skinned, darker-skinned blacks are at war. There's racism against the darker-skinned blacks. It happens in this world. There's racism in other countries, Asian countries, where people say, well, you're not from our province. Your nose is a little bit different. We tend to define ourselves by our differences, and those in power can too easily kind of work towards this kind of systemic racist thing. And so white people are not the problem. Black people are not the problem. Cops are not the problem. Hispanics are not the problem. Mexicans are not the problem. Jews are not the problem. Politicians are not the problem. Wait a minute. I do want to think about that one for another second here. Okay. Politicians aren't the problem either. But here's the thing. Sin is 100% the problem. The Bible talks about this sin virus that we've all kind of taken in, something far more deadly than coronavirus. This sin virus that affects every one of us, and in fact, we pass down to our children and next generations. The Bible talks about this in Romans 3:23, that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Romans 6:23 says, for the wages of sin is death. And this is not just physical death. Our world, we die today because we've walked away from God's plan, his good plan for this world. We've walked away and sin has entered our world. This is not just eternal separation from God, that kind of death as well. That's also something we need to have a relationship with Christ so we're ready for the next life. But we're not just talking about this separation either. We're talking about death now. The death of our relationships, the death of our community, the death of our unity, the death of our hopes and dreams, the death of the good life that all of us desire. James makes it explicit what sin does to us. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? When there is division, when there's disunity, James says that this thinking comes from the enemy of our soul. The enemy of our soul wants to divide us from one another, wants to divide our marriages and divide our families, divide our churches, and to divide our races as well. His goal is to get us to think only of ourselves, to say, man, I got these desires, I have these rights that need to be defended. You're going to hear them, and if not, we'll battle, we'll fight it out. In other words, it's my will, it's my way, it's my story. Not your story, but it's my story, and my story will prevail. But that only creates conflict, because then people draw battle lines. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? It's your desires, the sin that battles within you. We can only think of ourselves, our clan, our story. Racism is a worldwide human problem. And here in this country, it manifests itself as discrimination and racism against black people. The real problem is there's something wrong deep inside the human heart. And we all need to repent of our sin. We all need to repent of our failures. We all need to stop defining ourselves by our differences. That's what sin does every time. Now, this topic is so big that we're going to get back to it next week as well, and we will get to the Ten Commandments because they actually have something to say about this. Really important that I don't want us to miss. But I want to wrap up with three thoughts this morning. First of all, please listen to these, and maybe you don't agree. I ask you to consider them because I think they're important. I'm on a journey to figure things out too. I'm not going to say all lives matter anymore. I'm not going to say all lives matter anymore. Now, I have said it because I believe it's true. And you say, well, you're a pastor. Like, seriously, you don't believe like all lives matter? I do believe all lives matter. Jesus tells us we all do. But the problem with that is that we don't need an all lives matter movement. We need a Black Lives Matter movement. Not one that opposes the police. Not one that incites violence. Not one that has an extreme political agenda No, we need a Black Lives movement that acknowledges and brings to the surface this deep-seated pain and resentment and wound in Black people today, who bring these issues out and work towards the well-being of a group of people that should not be disenfranchised anymore. It means when we say Black Lives Matter, it's a statement that acknowledges the unique history of a people who have not always been told that they matter. It acknowledges that history. And so those of us who are white, those of us who hold power in society should use that power to give voice to the issue, to raise the issue, to address that issue. I'm also not going to say shoot the looters. I'm not going to say shooting the looters. I've never said it, and I'm not going to say it. Martin Luther King said two seemingly contradictory things. I want you to think about this. First of all, he said this: a riot is the language of the unheard. Martin Luther King said that. A riot is the language of the unheard. Now, at first glance, you'd say, really? I mean, seriously, Martin Luther King said that? I mean, it sounds like he's like advocating for kind of the riots. It sounds like he's okay with the riots. Maybe it's a justification for the riots. Maybe violence and looting are okay in his mind because it's just the unheard speaking more loudly. That's what we might think. But Martin Luther King also said something else. He said this: violence as a way of achieving racial justice is both impractical and it's immoral. It's impractical because it's a descending spiral ending in destruction for all. It's immoral because it seeks to humiliate the opponent rather than win his understanding. It seeks to annihilate rather than to convert. Violence is immoral because it thrives on hatred rather than love. So which is it? Riots to express rage or nonviolence to build bridges? Which is it? Martin Luther King was a brilliant man. He held the two things in tension. He held these potential contradictions, and he said both say something important. He understood, first of all, the rage, that the protests, the riots, they stem from unaddressed injustices. Injustices that make the lives of Black men and Black families and Black women, they feel unsafe. They don't feel like they can travel, do the things that we do as white people so easily. I think this means that the first thing we should do before we criticize the riots is to have compassion and to understand why they're happening in the first place. We need to understand why they're happening in the first place. And before we get upset and criticize the protests and the looting and the riots, we need to take the time to feel the rage of racism that is affecting and continues to affect the Black community. Understanding, this is really important. Understanding is not condoning. Martin Luther King didn't condone all that, the unrest, the riots. These statements don't either. But riots are the language of the unheard. And it's once we understand the rage, once we understand the despair that fuels these protests, as Martin Luther King did, it's only then that we can speak to the second part. Nonviolence as the only way to go forward, to move forward, to find solutions. And it's at this point that we identify the troublemakers. It's at this point that we begin to see that there's lots of people who want to hijack that movement. There are people who are taking bricks and they're putting them off to the side and they're getting ready to throw them and cause absolute chaos. It's at that moment that we realize that looting and all of this anger and violence and destruction is an anarchist dream where cops are being run over, where people are being attacked, where, again, a legit movement is being hijacked by those who want to perpetuate violence. No one wants looting. I just saw the story last night of an elderly black woman in New York City who was just crying out in front of at the front of her street, saying, as behind her was her burned out business. And she said, "I thought black lives mattered." She was broken up and devastated. A black business destroyed for no reason at all, except anarchists out of control. Let's stop the looters. Let's protect businesses, but avoid crass statements that miss why this is happening. Maybe it's better to say this: hear the frustration and rage, stop the looting and destruction. It doesn't rhyme, but it's way more balanced. But here is my biggest takeaway from all of this week. It comes from conversations with black friends through the years and conversations this past week and beyond. And it's this: when life goes back to normal for white people, it's not the same for black people. When life goes back to normal for me, and these protests are done, and the fires are done, and there's order in society, when life goes back to normal for me as a white person, it's not the same for black people. You see, I can go for a run. I can go for a run. I can run. I can go to restaurants. I can go different places. But my black friends, they've got this rock that they're carrying. They've got this burden. It didn't go away. It's with them still. And some people are saying, "I just hope we get these protests done and these riots done so we can go back to normal." But it's not normal for everyone. It's not a good place for everyone. There's still a lot of weight being borne by people we love and care about, by friends. And we have to acknowledge that. And we have to stand by people. I think we have to understand, and I know we hate this idea, of white privilege. We hate this idea. We hate this idea because it's a loaded term. It feels so unfair. It can be so extreme. We hate the idea of white privilege. But let's be honest. There are benefits to being a white person in America. The benefits of less scrutiny, less complexity, less potential conflict, and often more opportunities. It's time for us to acknowledge that all of this is true. Normal isn't working for everyone. So I will never know what it's like to wake up as a black man in America. I will never know what that feels like on a day-to-day basis. But I can listen, and I can learn, and I can love, and I can come alongside. I can build bridges. I can break out of my easier world to enter into a more complex world. These are things that I can do, that you can do. And I will never know, I'm never going to know what it's like to just want to go for a jog. Like, I just want to go for a run. I will never know what it's like for a black man to go for a jog and to carry this weight while they're doing it. The weight of racism. A weight that they carry with them every day. When this is over and it's like we're back to normal. No, it's not normal. It's not good. They're still carrying this weight. And I can't imagine how hard it must be to run, to jog with this weight, because it's very, very hard. I can't imagine how hard running and living it is with this kind of weight. But we have an opportunity. We, as God's people, can come alongside our black brothers and sisters, and we can bear some of that weight. We can come alongside our black brothers and sisters, and we can try to remove this weight that they're carrying. And some of you have influence in society. Some of you, you have power, you have position, you have a platform. Maybe you're a cop and you have influence in your precinct. Maybe you're a teacher, you're a leader, you're a business owner, you're a doctor, you have a management role, a leadership role at your office. I want to encourage you to use your influence, your power, your position, your platform to acknowledge these issues and to address them. All of us have a responsibility to bear this weight. All of us can play a role in removing the scourge of racism in this world. That's exactly what the law of Christ is all about. That's exactly what the love of Jesus compels us to do.